Perhaps some of you have found that time is a rather curious creature. Sometimes time can go so slow. Can't believe how long a sitting is. And sometimes it can go really fast on retreats, and you can't believe you're back at the meal again. It's like, I remember there were times on retreat where I thought that all we do is eat. Breakfast, and before I knew it, I was having lunch. Before I knew it, I was having supper. I said, boy, time went fast. And in this wonderful field of time, we have change. Things change. Suppose that's how time is really measured, is by things changing. Some of the reasons why in meditation time can seem to go so slow is that there's not a lot of change that happens. Unless sometimes when there's not a lot of change happening, not a lot of reference points, some people find the delight in experiencing something called the timeless, or a timeless quality. Just rather than being impatient, it's going on forever, it can just feel like this moment is timeless, without time. And it feels like it can go on forever. So that was a little bit of an attempt to do an introduction to the topic today of impermanence, change. And it's considered the kind of the cardinal insight or the central insight to this whole Vipassana tradition. It's like the entry door into the deeper insights of Vipassana. It's the door to liberation in this tradition. So it gets talked about a lot, the importance of impermanence, and to appreciate it and value it, be able to recognize it, to have wisdom about it. And it doesn't take a lot of wisdom, it doesn't take a lot of Buddhism to get wise about change. In fact, I've known people who are not Buddhists who've been wiser than a lot of Buddhists that I've known, because they have encountered change in dramatic ways in their life. And they've had to contend with it and deal with it and respond to it. And they bring forth the best of their hearts, the best of who they are, to try to respond, there tends to be a lot of wisdom that comes, a lot of maturity. I went home last night and my wife's reading a book called Far From the Tree. I've read a couple of chapters in it myself, and it's a wonderful book. And it's the man who writes it, a big book, he studies different families and different how it works to have children and parents. And he starts off with his own life story. He's gay, and what that meant for him to be gay, and his parents are not, and explores that. And then there's a chapter, the next chapter is on dwarfs. So dwarf families, and someone's family's a dwarf, and what that's like, and raising someone who's a dwarf, or being a dwarf as a parent, and the whole dynamic, what happens. And then deaf. People, what happens when you have a deaf child, or the parents are deaf, or both are deaf, and what happens in that? You know, these are people who, you know, sometimes don't fit into society because of how society sees them, and families don't ever. Something goes on there. So what happens? The book is a big part of the book is a study of love and the nature of love and belonging, not belonging. And it talks about children who have autism, who have severe mental disabilities. And then it also talks about other kinds of families. One of them, my wife says, talks about families where a child is a prodigy. He has some amazing ability. By the time they're, four, they've composed music and or do something, done great things. And, we have these amazing prodigy kids. And I don't know if the author says this, but at least my wife's strong impression as she was reading this is that the parents who had clearly children who were very challenged in some way in autism, Down syndrome, mental disabilities, physical disabilities, reported that they felt that they had grown, became much better people in being parents for people like that. There was a lot, to come to terms with that and deal with that. You have your ideals of what your children are supposed to be like and your expectation of what it's supposed to be like. And you have to let go a lot. You have to let go of a lot of your expectations, your desires, what you had in mind for yourself and your own life sometimes. Life gets turned upside down. And these parents reported they'd be much better people, much more accepting and loving for other people with all kinds of differences. And the children and the parents who had kids who were prodigies, the way at least this book reports it, they didn't particularly become better people. They were greedy, ambitious, wanted their kids to do great, pushing their kids, trying to make everything with their kids the best. An interesting difference. And it probably was not inherent in the different parents that they were going to go one route or the other, but rather it was a challenge that they were the situation they found themselves in that drew out of them different aspects of the mind or the personality, who they are. So sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for and what you get. So here we are, sitting here, and part of what we sit with when we sit on retreat is we meet ourselves in a deep way. I think of retreat practice is a time to a deep, deep meeting of oneself. And everyone has challenges. I think that life is a challenge. It's difficult to be a human being. And if one of the reasons I think it's inherently a challenge is that sooner or later we encounter the law of impermanence, the law of change. Everything changes. And some things change in the ways we don't want them to change. That they shouldn't change, really. I mean, so-called shouldn't. I mean, it's. But they do. And so, people die unexpectedly. People get sick unexpectedly, injured. People have all kinds of conditions come up unexpectedly. Last night I went home, but I also went to teach at IMC, that I'm teaching a class series. And a series of people came up to me after the class to talk, and one of them came to me and said, the last person that came to me said, her and her partner came to me and said, that do I know anything about how mindfulness can help people with schizophrenia? Nice. Why do you ask? Because we have a 19-year-old son who has schizophrenia. So we wanted to know, how can this help? And they were a beautiful couple, these two women. You could feel their love and their care, and they weren't ground down by this difficulty, challenge. The kid had been hospitalized. He might have been hospitalized right now, even. But I could feel their dedication. They were up for the task. They were going to try to help. There was all these unexpected things happen to people because things change. And so sooner or later, everyone has to respond to the changing nature of their lives, the fortunate things, the unfortunate things. And how do you know that the unfortunate things are the unfortunate things? Do you know? Do you know what's working through you? You know what's happening to your life? You know how you're developing and what's growing? One of the, I've seen many times, not always, but many times on retreat, that something will happen on retreat that we would hope never would happen. And we try to protect the retreat to some degree that, from these things happening. But then things happen that are unfortunate. And so it can be quite disruptive. But there's something about the practice on the retreat where the focus on the retreat practice is not the problem out there, because of the silence, because of being with oneself. The focus tends to be, what's happening with me? What's going on in me? What's my contribution to this? And the, what I've seen, the bigger that something's impacted someone, strong emotions, difficult emotions come up, the more it represents that it's touched something very deep inside of them. It's like it's gone deep, deep in the channels, deep down. And there's an opportunity then, because it's gone so deep, because of the strength of it, for a whole different relationship to open up, a whole different opening to happen, a whole different level of letting go, of maturation, of seeing, understanding, of insight into something. And I've seen people then too, who have then, at the end of the retreat, said, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. And as a teacher, I'm like, whew. Sometimes even, there was, I'm not going to tell you the details, but I remember once many years ago, making a mistake as a teacher. And clearly it was a mistake. And the person coming back and said, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because the person took, you know, it wasn't the person didn't, you know, the person really worked with it and saw through it and didn't get caught up in the blame part. Or so we encounter change, all kinds of change. And so the question is, how do we relate to change? What's our relationship to change? And of course, there's many answers to that. But an interesting way of approaching this question is to ask it these two ways as an exercise. And you might kind of go along now. You might even close your eyes as I ask this question and see if what bubbles up inside as an answer. Maybe if you don't think about it even, just what's the first thing that comes. So I, you know, chances are that for most of you, there have been time to time in your life where you have not been particularly wise. You're tired, hungry, nothing's working, and you're frustrated, upset, angry. Just things are just not going well. There's not much wisdom there. And in your unwisdom state, what is your gut reaction to change, to things changing? How do you look upon change? What do you feel about change? What do you believe about change? And then I'm confident that from time to time, you've all been wise. You've had wisdom and understanding. And when you have the most presence of mind, you're rested and well-fed and content and calm, have time to consider things well and be present for things. And from that mode of being, what is your response, most common number one tendency of how to respond to change, things changing. In this world of the response to change, how we respond, what our relationship is, lays really at the heart of this practice. And one of the reasons why we sit to be quiet, to calm down, to develop mindfulness, to see clearly, is really so we can see, among other things, but we can see that the relationship, the response that we have, and you could say to change, because everything's changing sooner or later, but the response to what's going on, what's arisen, what's occurring. What is our response to change? It has occurred to some people that the world of impermanence, the world of change, is equivalent to suffering. And so the only way not to suffer is to somehow disconnect from the world and from the world of change and impermanence and find something that's permanent and everlasting. It's a metaphysical principle or place or consciousness. For the Buddha didn't take it that way. He also recognized, as many people do, how impermanent and profoundly impermanent and changing the reality is. But he understood that there was not a direct equation between impermanence and suffering, but rather impermanent, the impermanent nature of the world, the impermanence times clinging equals suffering. And with an equation like that, if you take away one of them, if you take away the clinging, you don't get suffering. You just get left with impermanence, I suppose. The contribution, what's required for suffering, has to do with how we relate to that world of change. And how do we relate? Are we open-handed? Are we closed-handed? Are we open-hearted? Are we closed-hearted? Are we open-minded? Are we closed-minded? Are we for or against? How do we relate to change? And of course, there are many, many different ways that we relate to change, depending on circumstances and stuff. But sometimes there are kind of gut responses, you know, just some people I know just assume, the first assumption is that all change is a drag. All change requires things of us, all change is going to be hard, all change means I have to figure out what to do, I'm not up to it, it's too much. Other people have perhaps change means adventure, can't wait. Or, you know, all change is seen through the perspective of what's in it for me, myself, and mine. That's what, other times change is seen through the perspective of what's impact is going to have on my family? There's many perspectives we bring to it. But what about the wisdom approach to change? And I think one of the aspects of Buddhist wisdom is that understanding that helps us see what we're doing that brings suffering, that brings despair or distress or disappointment, or is going to bring that because we cling. There can be change that can be great and may even make you happy in the moment, but it's not going to bring you lasting happiness. I was really struck some years ago when I read a study that said that they've done studies on people who won big lottery jackpots, and the year after winning it, they're less happy than they were before they won. Of course, that wouldn't happen to you if you win. No one believes that it's happened to them. You know, you're so wise and able and capable, and you'll just kind of use that money so well, and It'll be good, good time. But those other people, they didn't seem to do so well with it. So here in the retreat, what happens to change here? There's all these changes in the course of the day. The day is made up of a whole series of changes. Waking up, maybe coming here to the hall in the dark. The first sitting is a particular way, going to breakfast, or first the Sangha service, to breakfast. All these different things throughout the day. There's a whole kind of unfolds, and I think one of the delights I think of being on retreat over many days is to start getting a sense of that rhythm and the repetition of the rhythm, and being able to watch in the repetition of the rhythm our shifting and changing relationships to different times of day, different kinds of experiences of what's going on. And I think it's a lot easier to develop self-understanding when you have a regular repeated rhythm that you're part of. Come back over and over again the same thing and see how it unfolds and see what's changed and what stays the same. Some things have been exactly the same every day, but your mood during those times has changed every day maybe. How you're feeling, your energy level, all kinds of stuff. And sometimes you can see, this is the same, but I'm the one who's changing here. And sometimes you're not the one who changes, but things around you change and see the change. So the overall theme of the retreat is the idea that we cultivate ourselves, prepare the ground in such a way that we're able to open up and look at impermanence, look at change with a strong, stable base. And so the cultivation of stability. You cannot create lasting, permanent inner stability of the mind or the heart, just be set, because nothing is set forever. But we can create it for a while. We can create enough of it that it becomes a strength that we carry with us for a while. Just like you can build up your muscles and you can be strong for a while, but if you want to maintain the strength, strong muscles, you have to keep exercising. But you can get away sometimes with exercising for a couple of days. And the tone stays. So the same thing with developing strong inner stability that comes with practice, regularity of practice, the wisdom and understanding of the practice, calming down, relaxing, developing confidence, and courage, and trust, as Max talked about yesterday. It's an important foundation. It contributes to the stability. To have confidence and trust in your ability to show up for your experience. And this, a certain stability and steadiness that comes, a willingness, a commitment, and ability to keep showing up. I'm going to show up, I'm going to face this. And it's been one of the great, I think, really important movements for my life, is to move from being someone who was scared a lot, scared, timid, in many, many areas of my life, to have the stability now, steadiness, to be able to show up and be present for many, many things that I wouldn't have been 30, 40 years ago. To have the ability, inner stability, trust, confidence to show up, be here. And all the changing aspects of what happens. To show up and be present for what I don't understand. To show up and be present in a strong way, confident way, when I've lost control of what's happening. So we cultivate ourselves, and so it's useful to think about this. What's the ground? What's the soil we're tilling and developing? And to recognize when there's kind of this instability, when we're easily triggered or upset or turned upside down. Perhaps what's needed in practice is to kind of come back and find a way, nurture oneself, find what it takes to become more stable. Do the things that cultivate confidence, that cultivate courage. Live a life that creates regularity and steadiness, that allows for a steady feeling inside. And then we're much better able to encounter and meet the impermanence of our lives, the changes of lives that goes on. We have more resources, more inner strength for that, more ability. And it's needed for this practice, because this practice is meant to be a very, with time, in its own time and place when you're ready, a very direct meeting and seeing the nature of impermanence and change. And sometimes, especially when people in the first maybe years of practice, sometimes it's seeing a lot of the change, the impact that change has had in our life growing up and in our formative times in our lives. Some of the changes have been difficult and painful, and there's a backlog of things that need to be resolved or worked through. And I remember once a friend of mine, a Zen teacher, was asked by someone who didn't know about meditation and said, that's a question, something like, what are you aware of when you meditate? And she said, all your unresolved issues. Now, that, you know, that was a bit of an extreme to say that's, you know, just that as an answer, because there's much more that can happen. But if you have something unresolved, it tends to come up sooner or later in meditation. Sometimes later, sometimes sooner, sometimes even sooner. And it's good. And then, you know, oh no, that's not what's supposed to happen. I'm supposed to be getting calm and concentrated and supposed to have bliss, all these great spiritual things. My other spiritual friends, they float on clouds. But so I think so part of it is to encounter how change has affected us over in our lifetime. If we haven't come to terms with it, haven't found some freedom with it, some ease with it, so to the backlog of things that need to be opened up to. And one of the beautiful things about impermanence, you know, impermanence has many different quality or aspects, effects. Sometimes when teachings on impermanence, it somehow suggests that impermanence is just a drag. You know, it's just everything impermanent, you know, loss. But without impermanence, there's no gain. Nothing, you know, there's no gain as well. In fact, you know, I've seen kindergarten teachers tell their kids that the tree leaves need to fall and decompose so they make the nutrients for the new leaves to grow. You need to have that change in order to have the spring to arrive. And that was a great lesson for kids. I hope they understand the implications everywhere else. But the impermanence, you know, in order to have anything, in order for us to grow and develop and not be stuck where we're at, impermanence has to operate. Impermanence is not just a drag. Impermanence is the means, is the core kind of vehicle through which everything in life is going to occur. So even though it's challenging sometimes, without it, nothing would occur. So part of the wisdom of impermanence is that, the wisdom of your inner life is that if you can be present for your experience without resisting it, wanting it to be different, without succumbing to it, without self-pity, without aversion, without delusions of grandeur, just be upright, stable, confident, breathe, and get out of the way, get out of your way. Then you'll find in time that there's an inner wisdom that knows what needs to unfold, what needs to open up, what needs to flow through us, and you can trust that. And if you need to have a rational explanation of why this inner wisdom is there for you, I'll offer you one. So you don't think it's some kind of strange metaphysical thing. And that is this analogy of making a really tight fist. Some of you have done this with me before. But if you've never done this before, you do it. Create a really tight fist. Now, probably you can do better than that. And so you're really, really hard, just like, almost like, so it gets white. It starts to ache and hurt. Really good, right? So keep doing it and keep it as hard as you only have to do one hand. I know some people are enthusiastic. So really, really make a good fist. Okay, so keep doing it until I tell you to stop, okay? So I'm going to tell you the story of how you catch a monkey in India. What you do is with the monkey is you take a coconut and you tie a rope to it, tie it to a tree, and you make a little hole in the coconut and put candy inside. And the hole is just the right kind of vertical hole, a horizontal hole or something, kind of slit, that the monkey can put its hand in flat like this. Are you really doing it tight? as tight as you can? Okay. And so then you put your the monkey hands goes in, and then it grabs the candy, but when it grabs and makes a fist, it's too big to go out. And the monkey is so greedy, he doesn't want to give up its candy, so it won't run away when the hunter comes and picks it up. Still doing it? Still doing it? Okay, you can let go now. So what I'm hoping that exercise has showed you, and hopefully you guys weren't just too good at this, that in order to make the fist that hard and tight, you had to keep redoing it. You had to renew the effort. Because the tendency, when you make that hard fist, what the fist wants to do is to relax, is to open. That's it, because you're going, and so you have to kind of do it again. So when we cling in the heart and the mind, we hold on, we resist. All that takes effort, work, tightening up. What it wants to do, all that effort, all that clinging, all that resistance, all what it wants to do is to relax. That's the direction it wants to go. It takes work to close down our hearts. It takes work to avoid and ignore our issues. It takes work to hold on to our identity. It takes work to hold on to all the things we hold on to. And if we get quiet and get out of the way, don't keep doing the clinging and the holding, everything wants to release. It wants to go. It's almost as if everything wants to, what your inner life, if you call it that, it just wants to be free. Freedom is not something you have to have an argument with anybody and lay out philosophically why you should become free. It's a good idea. It's what the heart wants to do. It can be complicated, all the stuff in there. It's not like just the fist that's so obvious. It's, it's layers and complications and issues. But when we can get out of the way, then things begin to flow and to move. So like resentment is frozen anger. So the anger can't flow and move. Guilt is frozen, maybe regret or remorse or frozen anger or hostility. We get stuck in that. Certain kinds of grief is frozen grief. Get caught in it. It's frozen because we're holding on to it or stuck in it or we're resisting it, keeping at bay. So keeping it, resisting it, keeping it at bay so it can't flow and unfold. And then we know from Charlie Brown that there's also good grief. And the good grief is the kind of grief that we get out of the way and let it flow and let it just do its thing, trust it. And there's something, I think, so wonderful to be able to sit still, to have this ability, sit, modicum of stillness, and learn how to get out of one's own way. And then allow the impermanence, allow the change to unfold, allow what's there to bubble up and move through, to trust the bubbling up, to allow it to be, but to do it carefully in the sense that to allow what's there to come, but then don't pick it up. Don't believe it. Don't disbelieve it. Don't resist it. Don't give it a lot of authority. But don't be disrespectful of it. Just let it be. Let it be. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. So we allow, part of this practice of impermanence and practice is to just allow things to unfold, allow things to flow. Chances are that if things start moving a lot, you have to be very careful that you're not somehow fueling it more than needs to be. Be quiet, be calm, be relaxed. It's okay. And then as the unresolved issues kind of quiet down enough, then there's other aspects of impermanence that get revealed through the practice. Start realizing the impermanent nature of our minds, our moods, our emotions, and how changeable and changing they are. Start seeing the impermanent nature of, one of the great things to see is the impermanent changing nature of identity. It's easy to get caught in identity. It's also easy to see that our identities are changeable depending on different circumstances we're in. Different identities come up and play themselves out. And so, you know, if, for example, here, you could say maybe my identity is to be a teacher, because I'm trying to teach you something. and if I'm giving a horrible talk, then my identity as a teacher maybe is a little challenged. But if I go home to my kids, they don't care less, couldn't care less. That's not my identity. It's there, my identity is to be a parent. Or I'm a husband, or I'm a son, or different things, right? And so the identity is also changing. But some people get hold on and cling to certain identities. And this is thinking, this is who I am all the time. Defining myself this way, sometimes negative identities. I'm not good enough, or I need to prove myself, or some identities we carry with us in all circumstances. We have some people have portable identities, and some identities, you know, get born in different situations we walk into, and something gets carried up. But what do we carry with us? And is there a permanent identity? Is identity itself something that's fluid and changing? And certainly that's part of the teaching of not-self in Buddhism, is that identities are fluid and changing. They're a product of activities of the mind, constructs of the mind, how we relate to them. And it's quite liberating to see that and not to kind of hold on to some identity, some belief, some way which we present ourselves, or some belief we have about ourselves, not seeing it as a fixed, permanent, essential element of the universe. That this is the way the universe was built, that you should be, you know, have this be this way. It's okay. And then the impermanence, as the mind, one of the paradoxes of this practice is as the mind gets quieter and quieter, more and more stable, stiller and stiller, that what drops away is a lot of the concepts we have, the ideas we have of what should and shouldn't be, what drops away of a lot of the desires for what should and shouldn't be, a lot of the aversions of what should and shouldn't be, a lot of the ideas. And when ideas and concepts begin to become quiet, there are times when a tremendous amount, a stable like environment like this, is seen that everything that we experience is constantly in flux, constantly in movement, constantly changing. When we have ideas about what things are, there's the idea of stability. But the way we experience things is an amazing changing flux all the time. So if even something simple as looking at this bell up here, and think the bell is stable, unchanging, it's not moving, just here, which is true. But is it really a bell? it's a bell right now because we're using it as a bell. But in some countries, some Buddhist countries even, very similar looking object is a spittoon. And I'd be up here. And then, you know, or it could be a pot, or it could be the begging bowl, or it could be donation bowl, or it could be, container for something. I once saw in downtown San Francisco a man who was begging, and to my surprise, he had a bowl, beautiful Japanese temple bell that was maybe about half, maybe a two-thirds of the size of this bell here. And I looked at it and said, where? Wow, does he realize what he has? You know, he had a bell, Japanese temple bell, beautiful. I thought of going back afterwards and buying it from him. But is it a bell? Is it a bowl? What is it? Is it a construct that he has a bell? The object is steady. The round metal things is steady. But the bellness of the bell doesn't reside in the bell. The bellness of the bell resides in our agreement. This is what we're going to use it for. Please don't think about using this now as a spittoon. So the construct is impermanent. We create it. And every time we come into the room, I'm not going around the retreat thinking that's a bell up there, that's a bell up there, that's a bell up there. Maintaining the bellness of the bell all the time, right? But when I come in here and sit down, I think, oh, that's a bell. I'm constructing, my mind has the idea, this is bell. That's a construct. Something arises in the mind and passes away. And then my attention, even though my mind is very calm and centered, my attention is not 100% focused on the bell, but rather, even if I'm looking at the bell, I'm seeing different parts of it, it's the perception, the different data of perception I'm taking in is shifting and changing all the time. I'm aware of sometimes the rim and sometimes the inside and the light shining on it and the darkness of it and the curvature of it. And my attention kind of, even though it's somewhat stable, there's noticing different parts of it. If I'm really preoccupied with the bell, I'm attached to this bell and the bellness of the bell, and then I might not be so fluid with my attention, my awareness, and I'm locked into the idea. But if I let go of the idea and just kind of take in the act of perception itself, the act of perception itself is a shifting and changing phenomenon. And what this tradition says is that if you can relax enough to just be with a shifting, changing nature of perception of what's happening, it's easier for the mind at that point to begin to let go. Let go in deeper and deeper ways. And so part of the aim of this practice is to get stable enough, steady enough, confident enough, that you don't have to always be referring to the past and the future. You don't have to be having ideas of what's happening. You don't have to be goal-oriented. You don't have to be be someone for anything. You don't have to think, you refer anything back to yourself. You can almost forget yourself for a while and just begin taking in the way in which the data, the sensual data, sensory data, perceptual data, arises and passing in our experience. And just kind of rest with that. Take it in. Feel it. Be with it. Be curious about it. What's behind the veil, the curtain of thoughts, of concepts and ideas? Because this sensory data that we take in is the building blocks upon which we create our universe, our world. And so to come back to the basic building blocks themselves and watch and see what goes on is one of the ways to begin to let go. To let go of self-identity, to let go of, you know, ideas and concepts, and to let go in such a deep way that the mind doesn't need anything. The heart doesn't need anything. Or at least for a few moments, to really let go so deeply that your heart can let go of itself and be free. So the practice of insight meditation points itself to the experience of impermanence, to change. And there's many different areas of impermanence, to change, that we can study and become aware of. Our relationship to change is one of them. We could understand how change in our lives, all kinds of changes that impacted us, for the better or for the worse. We can understand, we can learn how in the meditation practice to begin getting out of the way of impermanence, so we don't freeze our emotions, our feelings, and just allow the natural movement of release, of relaxing, to unfold and let things unfold, rather than always being in charge or resisting or holding on or trying to fix or make something happen. We can really trust in a deep, deep way what wants to happen. We can trust not needing anything to happen. We can begin understanding how we relate to change in the clinging, the grasping, the fear, the desires that we have in relationship to it. And we can begin understanding the impermanent, changing nature of our concepts of time, of self, of roles, of identities, many things. And then sometimes, occasionally in practice, when things get quiet enough, it's possible to understand or see the amazing changing nature, the river, the flow, the kaleidoscope of how perception occurs at the basic perceptual data level. To float on that, to swim in that, to allow it to wash through us, to allow it to clean us, to allow ourselves to disappear in the flow and the river of the perception and data as it occurs. So there's many, many different areas of this insight, this understanding of impermanence in our tradition. So as you continue, as you practice with this, remember that these are insights that are meant to appear when they're ready. They come and are revealed to you. Your job is to keep showing up and cultivate stability, some modicum of well-being or ease, and a modicum of confidence and trust. Keep coming back to that. That's what your job is, showing up. And then become aware, as you practice, that the different layers and different aspects of impermanence from time to time will show themselves to you. Don't go looking for impermanence. It'll find you soon enough. Let's sit and gather ourselves together.